And to answer some of the questions the president's proposal raises, we're joined by Greg Ip. He is the U.S. economics editor at The Economist magazine. Hi, Greg.
Hello, Madeline.
Well, could you walk us through exactly what these reforms would mean for the banks? Give us an example with one bank. How would things change?
Sure. Well, think about what a bank does. They do business on behalf of their customers. For example, they'll take a deposit from you to make a loan to me, or they'll buy and sell stocks and bonds on behalf of companies that need to raise money for investments and for, say, mutual funds and pension funds that want to invest in those stocks and bonds. They'll continue to be able to do that. But banks also trade stocks and bonds and other types of securities to make money for themselves. That's what the new plan will crack down on. From now on, if you're a bank that has deposits and has the benefits of taxpayer protection for those deposits, you can't do that kind of trading for yourself, what we call proprietary trading. The other change that's going to happen is that one of the main ways banks fund themselves is they gather deposits from ordinary customers. But under a law that was on the books since the early 1990s, no bank can have more than 10% of the deposits in the country. And so to get around that, banks can find other means of financing themselves. They can borrow in the bond market. Obama's plan would basically close off that loophole and make it that much harder for a bank to grow larger.
So would this, in effect, end proprietary trading?
It's hard to say at this point. It probably will severely crack down on it because most banks will decide it's not worth having that proprietary trading in order to they would rather stick with their regular customer businesses. And it's hard to say at this point what effect it will have. But what's happened in the last 10 years, and one of the reasons the administration has decided to tackle this, is that a lot of banks got tired of the old, dull customer business of taking in deposits and making loans or buying and selling stocks and bonds on behalf of customers. And some, and Goldman Sachs especially, discovered they could make far more money doing proprietary trading. That line of business will basically be over.
And a lot of people say, the president included, that that was the main reason for the financial collapse. So would this prevent future similar financial collapses?
Probably not. There were so many causes to this financial collapse that it would be impossible to pinpoint one in particular. I mean, if you think of some of the firms that failed, like AIG and Washington Mutual, they got into trouble by making loans to customers who couldn't pay them back. That wasn't proprietary. That was customer business. It just turned out that they made exceptionally bad decisions. On the other hand, one of the things that caused Bear Stearns to almost collapse was the trading of one of its proprietary hedge funds. So it would limit some of that risk-taking, but there are many other types of risk-taking that we'll discover. And it's possible that the only thing that this will end up doing is pushing that activity out of the banks, where regulators have a close eye on them, into unregulated institutions where they'll continue to pose risks to the economy, but we won't have a close eye on them.
Well, a lot of people have said we need to return to the Glass-Steagall Act, which was dismantled at the end of the 1990s. Paul Volcker, who's advising the president, has been a big champion of that. So is this what this is, a remantling, if you will, of Glass-Steagall?
Not quite. I mean, what Glass-Steagall, which was passed in the early 1930s after the Great Crash and the beginning of the Great Depression, what it did was it separated commercial banking, which was taking in deposits and making loans, from investment banking, which was underwriting stocks and bonds. Under Obama's proposal, investment banking can continue. You can still underwrite stocks and bonds if you're doing it for a customer. You just can't do it if it's for yourself.
And what does this all mean for you and me, bank customers, when we have our deposits in one of these big banks? What does it mean for us?
For the typical customer, it shouldn't mean anything. You shouldn't see anything different at all, unless you happen to be a customer who owns one of their hedge funds, in which case then you won't get to benefit from that hedge fund any longer. But for the vast majority of people who have bank accounts or who borrow because they're a homeowner or a small business from a bank, it shouldn't make any difference at all. Now, what the banks argue is that it's very hard to actually separate what they do on behalf of their customers from what they do on behalf of themselves. And so this proposal could make it very difficult for them to properly manage their risk, and that might hurt their ability to serve their customers.
How likely will this be passed in Congress? It's part of a bigger financial bill that is currently stalled in the Senate. So how likely is it that it'll get through?
Right now, I'd have to say that the odds are pretty low. What we saw as a consequence of the loss of the 60th Democratic vote in the Massachusetts election is that any proposal by the administration that doesn't have bipartisan support is going to have a hard time getting through the Senate this year. And Republicans have already raised significant misgivings about a lot of parts of the president's existing regulatory proposals, in particular his plan to create a new Consumer Financial Protection Agency. By adding in yet another proposal, it doesn't make it easier to get that thing past the Senate.
Thanks very much.
Good to talk to you.
That's Greg Ipp. He is the U.S. economics editor at The Economist magazine.
The media have spent the last few weeks chewing over the revelation in the book Game Change that Senator Harry Reid said privately that Barack Obama would be acceptable to the electorate because he was light-skinned and had no Negro dialect unless he wanted to have one. According to our linguist, Jeff Nunberg, the responses to Reid's remarks say a lot more about American racial attitudes than Reid himself did.
Just about everybody thought Harry Reid needed to apologize, including Reid himself. But why? You couldn't fault the actual content of the remark, that an African-American presidential candidate has a better chance of being elected if he doesn't look or sound too black. That may be a deplorable reality, but it's not controversial. Even George Will gave Reid a pass. As he put it on ABC's This Week, at long last, Harry Reid has said something that no one can disagree with, and he gets in trouble for it. But according to Liz Cheney, it still shouldn't have been said. She shot back at Will, "Give me a break, George. I mean, talking about the color of the president's skin, it's not the way that people that I know speak to each other." Actually, I can believe that about Cheney's circle. There are a lot of people nowadays who think of skin color as like a piece of lettuce caught in somebody's teeth. You should really try not to see it, and if you do, it's unseemly to bring it up. Reid's use of Negro stirred a similar sense of unease. In the Washington Post, Ezra Klein called it weird, and others went with awkward, unfortunate, or dumb. President Obama called it inartful, which was a deft way of implying that the lapse was purely stylistic. And some called it a racist slur, confusing outmoded with outrageous. But it's never been that. If Negro really were a slur, many older blacks wouldn't still be claiming it as their primary racial identification, and whites wouldn't feel so comfortable about repeating it. Still, the word does have what the African-American linguist John McWhorter called a tangy backwards flavor. And it can certainly be tinged with sarcasm, depending who's using it. Spike Lee coined the term magical Negro as a dig at condescending racial stereotypes in Hollywood films. And the tang was a little more pungent when Rush Limbaugh was playing a record of a white Al Sharpton imitator singing a song called Barack the Magic Negro during the 2008 campaign. But in Reid's mouth, Negro wasn't condescending or contemptuous, just clueless. To be fair, Reid may not use the word except in talking about language. His reference to Negro dialect may have been a garbled version of non-standard Negro English, the term scholars were using for black English until well into the 1970s. And the man isn't exactly styling. If he hasn't changed his racial vocabulary since Jimmy Carter was president, he hasn't changed his eyeglass frames either. But over a quarter century in Congress, he probably should have gotten out a little more. But even if we couldn't agree about its severity, Reid's offense clearly fell under the capacious heading of racial insensitivity. That phrase was introduced in the 1970s to broaden the range of conversational infractions. Even if you weren't an unregenerate Archie Bunker-style bigot, you could still be held accountable for merely being obtuse about race. But the phrase also turned out to be a useful way of enabling out-and-out racism to cop to a lesser plea. In fact, journalists almost never describe any remark as racist anymore. For the New York Times, there was racial insensitivity in Don Imus's reference to nappy-headed hoes, and the L.A. Times heard it in Michael Richards' nightclub tirade. And back in September, National Review's Jonah Goldberg conceded that there was some racial insensitivity in a few of the signs at the Tea Party protests, which included slogans like Save White America and depictions of Obama as a witch doctor with a bone through his nose. The implication was presumably that those protesters could have tried to express themselves more artfully. As the media use the term, racial insensitivity blurs the distinction between one N-word and another, or between Michael Steele's use of honest Injun and Trent Lott's suggestion that the country would have had fewer problems if we'd elected a segregationist as president in 1948. Whether those offenses are venial or mortal, malign or merely thoughtless, by the time they get to YouTube, they're all just gaucheries and gaffes, and they all require the same formulaic apology. Yet almost nobody called Reed to task on the one item that really did betray a deep-seated social prejudice, that word dialect. Of course, as linguists use the word, everybody speaks one dialect or another. Tracy Morgan and Patrick Stewart, Loretta Lynn and Diane Sawyer. But most people reserve the word dialect for varieties of language that are seen as expressive and colorful, but illogical and illiterate. Linguists have been pointing out for a very long time that those varieties all turn out to have a complicated and systematic structure of their own. But it's hard not to hear them through stereotypes of race and class. It's striking how many of the things people say in public about Black English are the same things they'd no longer allow themselves to say about the people who speak it. It's slovenly, lazy, ignorant, stupid, broken. Those stereotypes haven't really disappeared from public life. They've just been repurposed as attitudes about language. Everybody likes to invoke Martin Luther King's dream of a nation where no one's judged by the color of his skin. But most people are fine with judging somebody by the shape of his vowels.
Jeff Nunberg is a linguist who teaches at the School of Information at the University of California at Berkeley. Jeff recently sent me a CD by a country singer he really likes who I'd never heard of, but I'm sure glad I know him now. He's Vern Gosden, who died last year. So now I want to play a track for you. This is Chiseled in Stone.
You ran crying to the bedroom. I ran off to the barn. Another piece of heaven gone to hell. The words we spoke in anger just tore my world apart. And I sat there feeling sorry for myself. Then an old man sat down beside me and looked me in the eye. And he said, son, I know what you're going through. You ought to get down on your knees and thank your lucky stars that you got someone to go home to. You don't know about chisel.